Welcome to Human Rights and the Digital, a podcast where we present voices and perspectives of human rights defenders in Uganda. We focus on how technology is being used to the realization of human rights. To learn more, please visit www.digitalhumanrightslab.org. This podcast is supported by the Digital Human Rights Lab. Please be sure to subscribe.
Welcome to another episode of the Human Rights and the Digital. I am Charity Mugasha.
And I'm Philippa Ezeka.
Today we're going to be talking about something that is very, very, very pertinent to the times that we're in. On January 13th, 2021, at around 7:15 p.m., a day before the presidential and parliamentary elections in Uganda, Ugandans were locked out in an internet shutdown. Their internet activity went silent and online lives came to a standstill for close to 5 days when there was a partial uplift on the shutdown. In 2016, when social media was shut down, VPN spread like a wildfire and Ugandans could access the internet. This was not an option this time round. Beyond borders, we saw over 83 internet shutdowns happen in India in 2020. CPESA also reported that at the start of 2019, we had up to 6 African countries, including DR Congo, Algeria, Gabon, Sudan, Zimbabwe, Chad. And beyond borders, we saw over 83 internet shutdowns happen in India in 2020. CPESA also reported that since the start of 2019, we had up to 6 African countries that included DR Congo, Algeria, Gabon, Sudan, Zimbabwe, and Chad on other internet shutdowns for various reasons, of course. These numbers have recently grown over the time and spread to other countries like Uganda and Tanzania following through. In totality, up to 22 African governments have ordered network disruptions in the last few years. Are internet shutdowns becoming our new favorite tool? Today, we're going to be talking about the impact of the internet shutdown on Uganda. We have Ugandans that have shared their stories of how they were affected by the internet shutdown. And for more perspective, we have representatives from the police, the Uganda Police Force, and the Digital Rights Defender joining us for today's podcast. Now, stay tuned as we listen to the voices and the stories of different Ugandans.
Hello, I'm Ageno Road, based in Gulu. I operate a small business where I do my marketing online. And when the internet was shut down, it was really hard for me to market and reach my customers. And it was really a challenge for my business.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jenny. I was asked how the internet shutdown affected me. So I have both positives and negatives. For the, I'll start with the negatives. So for the negatives, we were not able to do our work. There was no access to even just emails. Everything came to a standstill. And then us with online businesses, we were not able to make any money during that time. Then we were not able to communicate with our family abroad. Yeah, then for the positives, I had time alone with my husband. It was like honeymoon again, like no phones, no distractions. Even if someone calls you and they have work for you, we were not able to do it. So yeah, there was some bit of silence and time to meditate and all great things. Yeah, that's it for me.
Good morning. My name is Priscilla. I am from Chizitolumu and Company Advocates Red Cross House. So the internet shutdown in Uganda literally just ruined my communication with clients I work with overseas. I could not get further information on their cases to build them more, and cases were at a standstill for a very long time. So we are just, you know, trying to catch up and see if we are still in time to save the situation.
Those were the stories and the voices of Ugandans on how they were affected by the internet shutdown. Joining us today is Jimmy Haguma, Acting Commissioner Superintendent from the Uganda Police Force. Thank you so much for joining us, Jimmy. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. I'm Jimmy Haguma, Superintendent of Police and I was acting as a commissioner for cybercrime, and now working with the Uganda Communication Commission as a cybercrime officer with the National CERT.
Thank you, Jimmy. Our second guest on set is Juliet Nafuka, a seasoned researcher and communications officer from Collaboration for International ICT Policy for East and Southern Africa, CPESA. Juliet has a background in journalism, has worked in the fields of communication strategy, publicity, branding, and market research across East and Southern Africa. A lot of her work has involved the exploration of avenues for African development through the intersection of heritage, rights, and digital technologies. She has utilized these skills in the advocacy of rights, including for access to medication and for online rights. More recently, she explores connections between online rights and social innovation in Africa. We're very, very happy to have you here, Juliet.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Nice. Great. Mr. Guma, we have listened to the voices of Ugandans on how the 2020 internet shutdown affected them. We would like to hear from you first and foremost, and we want to understand from your expert perspective, was the recent internet shutdown even necessary?
Okay, thank you so much. I want to begin from the angle that internet shutdown simply means online spaces are being either limited or in one way or the other, people cannot access the social networking sites like they have always done. Bearing in mind that actually internet permits or enables, is an enabler to communication, and which communication can either be constructive or destructive. It was only prudent to understand that the agitations and the interests of all different citizens were actually to go in that space and communicate their views, bearing that that's not a space that is well policed or that is actually adequately managed in terms of identifying who is doing what here and then. And also looking at the span of the time that this was a critical moment for the country, which determines very many factors. And looking at also experiences that were drawn from what the internet was used for or misused for in other countries that arose to turnovers and chaos and turmoil. It was only necessary under understanding national security and implication and the risks therein that it had to be shut down. And I do recall later on the head of state came in actually to adduce to this fact and explained why this was done. Thank you.
Juliet, as CPESA, you have conducted extensive digital rights research and hosted the African Internet Freedom Forum over the years. What is the cost of internet shutdown in Africa and in Uganda particularly?
Okay, yes. Often when we look at the topic of internet shutdowns, we try to understand whether they are necessary and proportionate at any given time that they're effected. So we've been looking at these for a couple of years. And in the case of Uganda, the first time we look at a disruption to communication, we note that that took place in 2011, if I recall correctly, when SMS, some messages were blocked because they contained certain words which resonated with the Arab Spring at the time. That was during the Uganda elections that we saw that happening. Fast forward to 2016, and again we see a disruption to communications, and this time national security being the argument presented. Similarly, this year, we've seen that argument come up again. However, in each of these instances, have these actions been necessary and proportionate? In the digital rights field, we do not think so. We do believe that it is mostly at these times that citizens should be able to share information, to access information, to verify what's happening, but also push back against misinformation that is spread online. The internet is not policed, as Jimmy has mentioned. However, increasingly we're seeing platforms come up and try to do some kind of policing. It's not policing, it is content moderation, actually. And in the case of Uganda, they picked up some accounts which were repeating content, skewing the online narrative, and in that effect we saw some accounts taken down by Facebook, and the same thing happened on Twitter. So that is one aspect of the internet shutdown. There was the management of misinformation, if you can call it that. The other aspect of it was now the social and financial impact. In the case of Uganda, each day that the internet was shut down in completion, we saw some 39 billion Uganda shillings lost, at least in the five-day span that the internet was shut down. Again, that is 32.9 billion Ugandan shillings. That's a lot for a small country like Uganda, which needs every penny out there to ensure that services are delivered, to ensure that things run, okay? Now, when we look at the current situation where we see just Facebook being shut down, we are seeing an expense of just under $450,000 US dollars being lost each day. And this is as of yesterday or the day before when social media was reinstated, but Facebook remained being shut down. So the costs are felt at a macro level, at a state level, but also by individuals. Considering that we're living in the times of Corona, many people have gone online to work, right? Mm-hmm. They're running businesses on WhatsApp. They're running businesses on Facebook. And in so doing, earning some kind of income, trying to remain self-sustainable. Mm. So the extent of that impact remains unknown, but it is definitely there. And I'm sure it will come up in some of the stories that emerge over time, that there is an unknown impact, financial impact there. And that is the most important impact, the impact at a micro level, at the personal level. But yes, we are keen on finding out what that is to really understand the true impact that these shutdowns have at a nationwide level.
Thank you. And speaking of a personal level, I think I was one of the very many people who went online, who managed to get online and, share sentiments on platforms like Twitter, just talking about how frustrating it became to work and to earn a living for people like us that primarily depend on the internet to earn a living, yeah? And there were very many conversations talking about brain drain. A lot of Ugandans kept saying that they just wanted to run away to another country because of the internet interference. It was very exhausting and it made it hard. I personally know a number of people who actually right at the onset of the internet shutdown, who immediately, took their COVID tests and booked flights and took the bus to Nairobi because their livelihoods literally depended on their ability to earn. And so, they went quickly, booked Airbnbs, accessed the internet and they were able to continue with their work. So I just wanted to ask you, Juliet, what do you have to say about these occurrences that have started to happen, the brain drain that is already happening, and a lot of people are sharing their interest in packing their bags and going to work in countries that are favoring internet work.
Yes, unfortunately, the shutdown introduced a new level of frustration for people who rely on the internet. And we are talking about the internet beyond social media. We are talking about platforms like GitHub, where people do quite a bit of coding being disrupted. We are talking about Google services, your ad services, people are running YouTube channels being blocked from their daily livelihoods. Granted, we need to recognize that there's a spectrum of people that we are talking about, those who can afford access to the internet and those who cannot. Some can afford to hop onto a bus or flight to another country, but some of us are stuck here, okay? And that frustration of wanting to go elsewhere became one of the common narratives online. You're looking across the borders and you're seeing that data is relatively affordable. The market can afford the products that some of these individuals are working on. Intellectual property online is respected. So there's a value and respect placed upon what the internet and social media has to offer societies such as ours. In the case of Uganda, you jump through so many loopholes to be online, to stay online. As a woman, for example, you go through various forms of online cyber violence. You go through the jeering online. People pulling your pictures left, right, and center and using them against you and your business or whatever it is that you're trying to do. So after going through all these loopholes or jumping rather through all these loops, then the internet is shut down. Naturally, your frustration and your willingness to go to another place at that point in time is heightened. But that should not be the way it is in a country like ours, which has so much potential, which has the richness of these brains that we're not quite appearing to want to serve or to maintain within the country. We do not also want to end up in a situation like we saw in Cameroon, where there were refugee internet camps created, for example, during the disruption of 2016, if I recall correctly, which saw people going to the borders, looking for places to access the internet to continue with their livelihoods, people traveling hundreds of kilometers, you know, just trying to access the internet. We do not want to get to that point. We shouldn't get to that point. So we need to have more of an appreciation of just what access to the internet, access to digital communication does for us as a society and as a country before we initiate some of these actions. Because often the damages persist far beyond the days that it has been shut down. People lose jobs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Somebody else then becomes a flavor of the moment, mm-hmm. and where you could have done and delivered that job, you're out. We're living in a gig economy where you have to be in the now. And if you're offline, you are invisible.
The gig is gone.
The gig is gone, essentially. So these are some of the undercurrents of the digital society that we really need to appreciate much, much more before some of these decisions are made. Yes, there's misinformation happening online, but it's online that we can also fight back against misinformation. Misinformation has always been happening, even via word of mouth. It's been there. The number of Ugandans accessing the internet is still relatively small to those who are offline. So, you know, there's so many dynamics that really need to be factored in because ultimately we do not want to lose too much of Uganda's brain, and a lot of it has already been left.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Juliet. One of the reasons government has always given in Uganda and beyond Uganda for these closures on the internet, disruptions of the network, internet shutdowns has been national security. I don't know what that means. But I want us to put context to this, Mr. Haguma. What exactly does national security actually mean? Because someone would think that for a country like Uganda with a low internet usage of about 23.7%, I stand to be corrected in the numbers, Uganda would be the last to disrupt internet access because, I mean, there's a small section of Ugandans online. So it looks like you're already worsening a worse situation. So what does national security mean in this context?
Yeah, thank you so much. I would like to define this from what we call the CTI, which is a cyber threat intelligence analysis. One thing that we need to appreciate is that whereas Uganda jurisdiction is talking about the few number of people who actually can access the internet, we also don't forget that we also have Ugandans in the diaspora that are still active on the internet. One of the challenges and one of the critical things that came up is that during the time for elections, we saw a mushroom of very many YouTube channels, and some of these channels were actually not being run by Ugandans in Uganda, were run by Ugandans outside Uganda. We saw a number of different plans, organizations, and arrangements, not only just to use the internet for the value of business, for the value of extending a reach and helping someone, but also a misuse. That's why we have legislations in place. You'd have said, why didn't you pull the legislation in place to be able to act? When we talk about national security, you're talking about threat modeling, you're talking about risk projection, and it would have only been defeatist if the people who look at threats online were not able to project and say that if this is not done, it's what we call the necessary evil. If it's not done properly, then we would see a lot of agitation, we would see a lot of misinformation, we would see a lot of issues come back and forth. So it's beyond just the people who actually go online in the country, but those who are in that space. And that's why we no longer talk about that if you're one person holding one account, then that's the total number of people. You can be one single person, but can have five, six accounts that you're running. And that means the viral aspect, the multiplier effect, and then in between there, who is going to tell the truth? What's not true and what's not right?
Yep.
Just to bring you a story of yesterday when there was a crash of one of the UPDF helicopters, I think you may have seen the sentiments and the communication that people went out there. So we have lost the value of actually maintaining our own culture. If anything comes up, I'll rush at it. And you know why that is done? Because also the internet and social platforms provide you with anonymity. So because of the anonymity, that means that it's also not very easy that law enforcement will be able to actually identify who exactly is doing this and that. And these platforms are also policed using global environments. We talk of, for example, Twitter has its policies. We talk of Facebook has its different guidelines that it depends on. These are not domesticated to the national guidelines. So we are in the internet has its own culture. And so it may not be perfect enough to say that you will leave it running when you don't have the amenity actually to dissect and carefully run it out. If I can take an extra minute, we've seen other countries that have advanced in technology and have decided not to actually go for the shutdown, but have actually decided now to carefully identify who is misusing. But in the current state, you could carefully identify who's misusing, but you cannot easily stop the viral effect. You cannot easily stop the speed. Internet is very fast.
Yeah.
By the time you drive the patrol car to the next incident, thousands of people are already giving their comments, dissecting, cropping, photoshopping. And so you have the other challenge of evidence. How are you going to adduce this evidence? Digital evidence is viral. Digital evidence keeps changing over time.
Yeah.
So if you want to manage this risk, then you go for the aspect of transfer the risk or assume the risk or avoid the task. And so that's why probably they thought, maybe for this time we turn it off, we turn it back. It could not be maybe the right attitude to go for, but it's a lot to research and understand. How do we, first and foremost, sensitize people to go for digital hygiene? How do we also, at the other time, provide mechanisms that can actually carefully dissect and identify those who are misusing these spaces without necessarily having everybody go off in a blanket?
Thank you so much. I think, and this is very helpful, I think someone would say internet shutdowns is a price we pay for government maybe failing to sort of moderate what activity happens online. But also looking at things like, I don't want to call it failure, but the mishaps around failing to implement cyber legislations like the Computer Misuse Act, would you say this is a price we are paying for government failing to sort of moderate online spaces?
I would say for a fact it may not necessarily be government, but it is the technology that we are dealing with.
Right.
When you talk of the Web 2.0 and now you're talking of the 5G frameworks, these have been designed purely for chat. They have been designed to allow people to express themselves without necessarily having to know who is speaking. But when you come back to legislation, even if you have a matter in court, the lawyers want to say who did what, when, how, and where. Now, some of these questions are very difficult to be answered when you talk about now living beyond internet that is run on one channel. Now, most of the social platforms are run on cloud platforms. Cloud platforms mean that you actually do not care about how much space is there. Yours is to use the service, infrastructure as a service. So the technology itself requires an extra review in terms of marrying the technology and the law. Even countries that have come in to acquire these tools have been castigated that actually you're infringing on the privacy of people. The famous tool that is being discussed is Pegasus and others. So much as you want to acquire the technology, still you will be castigated. If you want to police the space, you will be castigated. If you shut it down, you will still be castigated. So I think you can't eat your cake and have it. It's something that we need to build morals. We need to do a lot of awareness. But above all, we need to maybe come up. That's why organizations like now Facebook recently introduced the one-time password access, either it's by your email, but by your telephone number. Probably soon we will be saying it's not just the email, but it should be your telephone number. And not just your telephone number, but the number that was registered in your names. And this will help us to come clean. If you're speaking clean, you shouldn't be afraid. If you want to speak in anonymity, then probably you need to find other spaces that will not necessarily infringe or cause threat. I think we've seen this in recently now, Tunisia has gone back to
the violence, because, I mean, one photo was sent of someone who was being arrested. It's true he was being arrested, but as you broadcast it, we pick it with different mindsets. And we then call upon everybody, rise up, come from where you are, let's get running. The last was a video clip of a gentleman who was somewhere saying, please come this day, everybody come out on the streets. Yeah. If you don't come out, if we ban your car, do not blame us. I think if government just sits back and leaves this, and millions of people are seeing this, I believe if you know what happened in the genocide, it begins in the mind. Mm. If the mind is not well tamed, people can do crazy things. My last story is of a famous sports journalist who was just stabbed just hours back in Mbarara. And if you can see what's happening right now on social media, everybody is taking on their own story. But if you read in detail, you see that this started in the mind. If, how can someone stab a person to that extent? Because of what has been posted, because of what I have known about you. Before I verify it, I go to act. As human beings, we do not take a lot of time to verify or to actually establish the truth of something. So government will not be there to speak. Much as we talk of national guidance, I think we need more of cyber guidance so that we can see how best do we navigate in these spaces. They are good, but also have the other bad side of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jimmy. The internet is here to stay. Yeah, we have transitioned into the fourth industrial revolution, and life as we know it is definitely not going to be the same. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is a lot of us and a lot of, you know, human rights defenders are using this space to speak up on injustices in, you know, previously where it was not as easy to go and say, you know, they're killing somebody here or this is happening. Police is maybe not easily accessible. So it's also a very useful tool for human rights defenders to be able to say, look, this is happening. This is the scale at which it's happening. And we need to bring this to the attention, you know, of the entire country. Yeah. So I don't know, Juliet, since you have access to a lot of data and information and, you know, you've been researching for a while, how do internet shutdowns affect the work of human rights defenders in Uganda? And, you know, also, what does an internet shutdown mean in a time where the internet is the greatest tool that can be used to fight against human rights violations, against, you know, we have COVID, a pandemic that's happening, and people need to access the information that they need to just keep alive.
Yeah, those are two monster questions. But before I answer them, I'll just ping back to what was said about the laws that we have. We have fantastic laws in Uganda. The problem is the opportunistic use of some of these laws, some of which detract from people really believing in them or even using them. So when we see laws related to the internet being used against people speaking up, against women who have fallen victim to online crimes, you know, there's a problem there. So, and you know, it's not just a problem of Uganda. We've seen in many other countries where the laws meant to help manage and sustain activity online have been used instead to silence dissent, to silence critical voices. And that's where that's the gray area that we find ourselves in, even as human rights defenders. Mm? So when we shut down the internet, we are blocking down the heartbeat of it all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're blocking information.
Yeah.
Okay? And we are living in a time, you've called it the fourth industrial revolution. It's all about information. It's all about data. Mm-hmm. So when you lock people out of that, we are literally cutting the lifeblood out. And we are stopping everything from happening. We are stopping the opportunity to push back against misinformation. We are stopping the opportunity for the media to do their role as society's watchdog. We are stopping the opportunity for civil society to do what they're supposed to be doing around human rights, creating an enabling environment for marginalized community. We are stopping the opportunity for persons with disabilities, for example, to engage. They do not have the capacities that others do sometimes in terms of easily calling up someone or walking from one place to another. Or so for some communities, basic access is literally a lifeline, okay? But also issues around anonymity come up. People reporting on the grounds of anonymity. Yes, there are toll-free call lines where one could report one thing or the other, but online also offers a new level of anonymity, which, yes, has been detrimental for some, but has also created an enabling environment for some cases, especially for the media to work on, for sources to, you know, freely share information, share insights, and report situations that are for the good of society. So there are all these issues that are creating an enable, rather, human rights defenders need to create an enabling environment for the audience that they work with, for the communities that they're trying to work with. But the minute we block or disrupt one of those channels, we are literally creating a handicap to the goal of what some of these organizations are trying to do, including us. We're all about trying to create collaborative networks to bring more people into the online society. It's a fantastic place to be as a woman, as a child, as an adult, or as anyone, if you can be there. Even for those who are not directly online, the benefits are there for them to be reaped if we can create a more enabling environment for access to the internet.
Thank you so much, Juliet. We live in an era, the 4I era, like you said, it's all about information and data. But also we've seen citizen journalism coming up. And of course, with citizen journalism, you don't expect less than things like fake news. Everyone wants to be the first to break the story. Everyone wants the byline, you know, everyone wants to be up there. And there's so much hate speech, of course, that we're going to expect, some of which this content is even promoting violence. Mr. Jimmy said, the video that went around saying, everyone, starting the 3rd of February, don't do this or do this. So yes, all these things are existing. But I think it's safe to say Uganda is in its early stages of the internet use. I don't know if that's right. I stand to be corrected. But yes, I feel like we are getting out there. People are starting to understand the internet and they're using it for their own good. And there's so much good that also comes out of it, even amidst all these things. Don't you think, and I want both of you to answer to this, don't you think it's time we moved past internet shutdowns? And perhaps we can use this platform to advise the government on what other alternatives they can use, aside from internet shutdowns. Because, I mean, it might take a while to fight fake news or hate speech, because these are elements that exist on the internet, because with the internet comes these other sides of the coin. So isn't it time we moved past internet shutdowns? What more can be done to fight fake news than using internet shutdowns as the remedy?
Yeah, thanks a lot. I think one of the things that is for a fact is that this space requires to be regulated. And I remember one time we were discussing this and said, why you regulate this space? I think there is nowhere in this world that there is no regulation. Right from your home, you have regulations. At your workplace, you have regulations. Why do we have regulations? So that you don't live in excess, but you live within the required stipulated guidelines. I recall one time there was a call to have all online broadcasters, bloggers, get regulated and licensed. And of course, that faced a backlash. We say, why do you want to take this money? Why do you want to do this?
And how far is that, by the way?
Yeah, we've had the introduction of e-services platform now for people get licensed. We have most of the online broadcast publishers get licensed. The purpose of this really is, one, to create this community. Once this community is created, then in the technology angle, we'll talk of segmenting. Much as everybody is on the platform, not everybody is misusing the platform.
Yeah.
So if you are actually the people that are using this platform usefully or meaningfully or within the ambit of the regulations, then you need to be segmented in your own room. You want to create this online space, but create rooms from the technical angle. Further into the technical angle, that's what they call subnets. Now, in other countries, they have actually created these different subnets. You remember for a fact that at one point, the president, while still sitting, the president of the USA, his account had to be put off. That's what we call segmenting.
Yeah.
Now, why? Because this social media giant sits in the very country that it's regulating. For a fact, all these big giants do not sit in Africa. They may have extensions of branches here and there, but they are speaking to the entire world. So what that simply means that if we have regulations, if we have proper segmenting, then you could simply know that if you're going to turn off those who are misusing, it's those who have not been regulated, those who are not registered, those who don't speak to the frequency that is in tandem with the stipulated guidelines. We do recall for a fact that you are free on the internet. You can post the photos you want of your own choice. You can shoot your videos because it's your freedom. Yeah. But if these very videos are going to speak against certain norms, you're going to speak against, you're going to do child exploitation, you're going to speak, you're going to harass people, you're going to encourage people to do illicit trade, then you're speaking against not only the norms but the international regulations. It's unfortunate that when the shutdown goes, the good, the bad, and the ugly all get affected at once. Yeah. But how can we dissect this? So that's why such regulations were called in, but it was challenged. I think the matter is still in court. So we wait for court to decide. But if we perceive it in the angle that if you're regulated, then you belong to this space, it means that even if there is a blackout, you continue to work. Because for you, you have a specific guideline. You have a specific norm that you've signed to. Today, if you're getting a Facebook account, you don't need anybody's permission. Many times they ask you to select your age. My own child can choose 18 years. Mm. And can actually, so Facebook will not come to verify my age. So I think we need to be conscious that these, much as Facebook, Twitter, they say we have policies, we have regulations, but how are they going to follow them? Okay, if they can turn off an account and say it doesn't meet the requirement before it has been escalated to them, and yet when you escalate a matter to them, it takes hours. I think we need to weigh in between and understand, where is this? Is this the goose and the gander? Are we actually having this space properly managed? So coming back to your questions, one of the things that if we regulate these spaces and have people properly trained and properly guided by regulations, then we'll create that community that is regulated. And then the community that is not regulated, it means that it has a higher risk of abuse. It can mismanage, it can actually pass on what we call false news. During the COVID-19, these spaces turned out to be infodemics because people are now pushing out content. On the other bit of it, I would only say that as much as possible, we can draw away with the shutdown if we learn how to conduct ourselves on such spaces. All of us are active on these spaces, but there are content that people post and you say, oh my God, not this time round.
Yeah.
Why did you, why say this? Someone writes a whole story and you see that actually this is not just misinformation, but disinformation. And so, and then the other bit of it is acquiring more technical mechanisms that can actually carefully dissect. Ask yourself a question, why you go to certain countries, your phone, which you move with in Uganda, may not work in that country. Why? Because they've created a benchmark, they've created a threshold of the devices that are acceptable in their environments. All these countries regulate their spaces, all these countries have standards, and so if we develop these standards, then I think it will be better, but we're still far from that because everything that comes up in this country is taken as politics.
Yeah.
And so, it's very difficult that actually, even if you have the good idea, they'll be thinking that you're just trying to find your own means to satisfy your own ego. So it's a long way in building our norms and cultures and ethics and what we believe that will impact how much we can regulate this space.
Interesting. Thank you so much. If there's one thing we can go with from this podcast is that we are ready to move beyond shutdowns. You've mentioned that.
Absolutely.
Another day we shall talk about the segmentation, which is also silencing dissent, but that's a story for another day. Yeah. Juliet.
They're all stories from the same page.
Yeah.
Right. So it's great to hear that we need to live in a world where we are past shutdowns. But on the issue of regulation cannot be decided by one party. The internet is not a national, it's not a national thing. It is a global product, right? Mm. So by nature, its framework, the rules of its conduct will have to be based beyond a national jurisdiction. So this is why we have platforms, or rather initiatives like the multi-stakeholder model of internet governance, which is trying to address this. It's trying to bring the different players, the different stakeholders of the digital society, that's the private sector, human rights defenders, governments, everybody who has a say in how the internet should look like and behave like. But in as much as those efforts are ongoing, we still have our countries which are, running the internet according to their own rules, mm-hmm. right? And in so doing, the decisions created by a few have an impact on millions. And the millions are not necessarily guilty of doing anything. Mm-hmm. Across the world, there is misinformation, there is disinformation on the internet, but it's also in the internet that you're getting the pushback. It's on the internet that people are learning the skills to identify false information. They're learning the skills to pick up an image used 10 years ago, now showing up as an image from yesterday. But when we block, we limit the opportunity for that. In 2016, January, few people knew about VPNs in Uganda. Few yep. people using VPNs.
Yeah.
Come the elections are in February, right?
Yeah.
By March, it was, you know, the talk of the day. This time round, it has become the norm, right? People didn't even have to think that hard about it. Even before the elections, people on VPNs.
Yeah.
Now that social media has been lifted, it's likely that people are going to remain there because it's now become part of the digital identity, which means it may have an impact on OTT. So some of these decisions on regulation need far more consultation than we currently see. Some of the laws that we see introduced in countries like Uganda need far more consultation than we see, okay? Having a directive, a state presidential directive on shutting down this or introducing the other is indicative of a state that is not willing or always ready to have those consultations, to get that information, to make decisions based on informed feedback, on a body of evidence, of which there is. So that is where we want to be. If we want an internet that is open and accessible, we also need to appreciate the different players and the roles that they all have to play in how some of these decisions are defined and reached. On the issue of an open internet, it's and generally misinformation, as you had asked in your initial question, misinformation has always been there.
Yep.
I'll take the example of Africa as well. It was known as the Dark Continent for a long time because the people who wrote the story of Africa referred to it as that, the Dark Continent, jungles and lions, mm-hmm. right? Now, here we are online and we're able to start changing that narrative. We are now content creators as opposed to content consumers. But when you lock more of us out, you're locking out the opportunity for some of these identities created for us as Africans to be changed, to be challenged. Right? So those are some of the underlying issues that, you know, need to be factored in. Who is going to tell our story? Whose story are we consuming if we keep blocking the opportunities for people in Africa to be online, to share their narratives in languages that they are comfortable with, right?
Yeah.
So there's much more to the internet than we see at the top level. And that all feeds back to the need for a multi-stakeholder model in managing the internet and in bringing some of these arguments to the fore when decisions are made.
Thank you so much, Juliet. I think you've answered what I had in mind because CIPESA is a big player when it comes to ICT policy and internet education. What initiatives are in-house for CIPESA or even with partners? What initiatives have come up from this, the private sector, in terms of lobbying against internet shutdowns, but also doing education, internet education, to when it comes to internet shutdowns?
Okay, so CIPESA, we are in a position where we engage at a national, regional, and international level. And all of it being through the lens of using the multi-stakeholder model, okay?
Yeah.
When we have engagements, we want to bring the different voices on, which is why we've worked quite closely with the likes of Jimmy Haguma in here to bring in some of the perspectives or arguments from the police. We have worked with government representatives to bring some of the ideas or positions that the state of Uganda has. We have worked with the African Union, the Internet Governance Forum, the global Internet Governance Body, rather, on bringing these issues, the United Nations, UNESCO, you know, just trying to, for one, take information beyond our borders, but also bring in some of those arguments. So those are ongoing activities. Beyond that, we also have initiatives that we run, such as the Africa Digital Rights Fund, where we fund other entities to do work around digital rights use. And this could be in a whole range of issues related to the internet access, its use, and perceptions. So we have had entities working on content generation, others working on data privacy, strategic litigation, media development, digital security. So, you know, they're trying to create an awareness and build a community advancing digital rights in Africa, and, you know, through the various projects that they're doing. We also do quite a bit of research to form the basis of some of the arguments that we take to the different national, regional, and international bodies. And some of that work is fed by the project that I mentioned a few minutes ago. So there's quite a lot at any given point going on. We often look at the internet through the lens of access to information, freedom of expression, digital inclusion for marginalized communities, you know, trying to be in a position where we're consistently looking for where the gaps are in the digital society, not only in Uganda, but in other African countries as well. And, you know, in so doing, growing the collaboration, which is what we're all about at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Juliet. And we would like to sort of end on a self-care note. While we absolutely do not condone the shutdown of the internet for any reason whatsoever, one of the positives that people reported largely in on different platforms was the positive aspects that came out of the, you know, the shutdown, which was the digital detox. Juliet, from your perspective, where is the place of digital detox in this digital rights and access conversation? Especially, you know, touching onto what Jimmy was talking about, like, we are all susceptible to manipulation when we are online. So depending on the mood and, you know, the state that we're in, an image, a video could easily, you know, radicalize us. And I think there's a responsibility within each and every one of us to say, hey, perhaps I should take a step back. Perhaps I should, you know, first cut myself off all of this information, internalize what I have been receiving before I can get back online and react. What would you have to say about that?
Well, your question is insinuating that we're all digital addicts, for starters.
Yeah.
We need to seek medical help.
Or perhaps we could, does it happen? Is there a percentage of people online that are struggling with that addiction? Or is it something that is not a very big problem?
No, there are definitely many different kinds of struggles related to being online. Of course, there's the struggle of addiction. Some people cannot live without being online, for whatever reason it is. I wake up at night, I need to be on the phone. I'm walking, I need to be on the phone. You know, there's that. There is the issue of, look at it through the gender lens of women coming online and all they're finding is attack. Mm-hmm. Attack after attack after attack. And this is all because they posted a picture of themselves. They had a comment on one thing or the other. So when the internet is shut down, you said that for some this was, you know, a point of happiness, right? Because they did not have to face those things anymore. However, it raises the issue around consent and agency. Mm-hmm. Is it for someone else to decide when I should tune out?
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. Somebody else decided and I lost my job. Somebody else decided and I've lost my business, you know? So the issue of choice comes up, because in so doing, in the absence of choice, you're simply creating frustrations, which is what we spoke about earlier about the brain drain, right?
Yeah.
So part of digital literacy includes the capacity, the skilling of people in knowing how and when to tune out. Mm-hmm. And that is something that perhaps is not spoken too often about. But by human nature, you need to tune out of things. You eat too much sugar, your teeth fall apart, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So tuning out of the online realm is something that is a muscle that we really need to strengthen. Mm-hmm. And it needs to start from an early age. If you watch kids today, at least this corona period has made some kids total addicts. It's no longer about television. It's about the tablet or the phone that their parent is giving them. And their parent is actively giving it to them because they do not want to be disrupted.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So those are some of the problems that we see coming up in the future, right? We're dealing with an age group of people who are living online. All they know is online. Their friends are online. Their thinking is all online, right? So for them, building the muscle of a digital detox is something that we need to start teaching from round about now.
Absolutely.
Yes, but at the end of the day, people need to have the choice of when they want to tune out. They need to have that agency. It should not be forced down.
I absolutely liked that you talked about the need for a guide. And I think it also ties into what Jimmy had mentioned earlier. Like, we need to have a sort of framework that is guiding how people, you know, operate in the digital realm, you know, all the way from what you post, what you say, how you react when you tap out. We need to have this digital literacy all the way from a really, really young age. So maybe to close off, and this actually goes to both of you, I'm asking you to react to it. We clearly need to create a survival guide. How does one survive during an internet shutdown, considering now the internet is not our, considering that the internet is now our new playground for work, for business, for entertainment, for communication with family, with friends? How do we survive in the event that there is an internet shutdown?
Okay, for me, that would be more like for the business angle probably, and how do you keep yourself communicating? When there is a shutdown, it means that actually the communication on the worldwide space is off, but communication on intranets still remains. I think we need to, much as we want to run our solutions on cloud, because that's where you'll have very many people, you can touch people across the world in a click of a button, you need to also have what we call a backup. And so speaking from the IT side, is what we call a DMZ, a demilitarized zone in any security framework. You have a server that is not necessarily pointing to the internet, but points to the intranet. Now, breaking this down for those who are listening is that you need to have a backup plan. Much as you're going to run everything on internet, just know that even internet can be disrupted. Just like when you have an event, you must come with a generator. Because you never know when power will get off, but you must keep running. And then on the businesses we run, we know that we thrive on the capital, because there's a lot of social capital. I was looking at the social optimization engine, and we can easily get these people available, but we should always know that at one point you can still go back to our traditional aspects that we've done for. Of course, we don't want to go back. Going back to tradition means you're going backwards. But fact be told, we can't forget where we came from, and we can't forget our history. So these things are bound to happen, but if we can balance it out, probably you're having intranet in your solution probably taking 20% and then internet taking 80%. When you're running on the intranet, that means you're going to be reaching few people, but you can still remain. There can still remain a dim of light that can keep you running. And then diversification. You need to diversify if you're going to survive through this, because we can't all run on these platforms. And I remember we saw people diversifying. People went back to the SMS. It doesn't necessarily mean that the entire communication was cut off. People are active on SMS. Even those who had forgotten how to attach some clips, how to attach images, we saw people running around with different phones and were able to attach SMS, were able to, much as the unicast SMSs were affected, because again, you don't want to have people mobilizing, but back and forth. And it felt so unfortunate, because with the internet, every time there's a message, there's a pop-up. Now with the SMS, you have to just keep checking all the time to know if a message has come in. But we kept running. I remember I was running on SMS for most of the time. And up to today, I think I'm literally now more inclined onto SMS, because, and like my friend said, Julie, that, you know, I still have to run the VPN, because you're not sure when you will get disrupted again. Thank you.
Wow. Julie.
Yes. When we look at shutdowns, you're talking about how to live during a shutdown. Mm. The underbelly of that is people sometimes die while you're trying to live. And I'll refer to a story that emerged from a recent workshop we hosted. And one of the speakers spoke of a lady who couldn't access basic medical instructions and assistance and lost her life. I'm sure that is one story of many others that have taken place, that took place. But this is a story not unique to Uganda, it's unique to many, it's common in many other countries where internet is suddenly disrupted, and you know, for those few moments initially, people are not sure what's going on, and unfortunately sometimes lives get lost unnecessarily so. So surviving during an internet shutdown is sometimes an issue of life and death. Mm-hmm. However, it also means that perhaps new technologies need to be considered. We have been seeing Tesla talking about their Starlink. Mm-hmm. Tesla, you know, is reinventing how cars are operating with the electronic vehicle movements. Perhaps it may reinvent how the internet is accessed. It may not necessarily have to be an entity like Tesla, but perhaps there's a different kind of way, there are different ways of accessing the internet. There are also community networks which are gaining popularity. And these are networks that operate outside of the current technologies that people are using to access the internet. So for some, they remained online. So maybe people are going to appreciate the alternatives a whole lot more than they previously did. But nonetheless, we went back to SMSs. Mm-hmm. We went back to calling people. Not sure if you used a pigeon to send your message across, but we were slowly getting there.
Yeah.
So yes, we sometimes end up going back to older ways of communicating. But what we lose out in that is the social aspect, which social media has enabled. There's a community there, mm-hmm. which SMS does not allow. SMS will allow you to receive one story, and that story will become your one truth, as opposed to online platforms, which allow for many stories to come out, and you can go look for which truth you want to believe in. You can go look more readily verify it if you want to. So that's the underbelly of the internet shutdown. But yeah, we somehow maneuvered. We came out of it. We're here to tell the story. We do not want to go back there again.
Absolutely do not want to go back.
Thank you so much, Juliet and Mr. Haguma. It's an interesting conversation that we have had today. But if there's one thing I want to leave with our listeners, but also the other stakeholders, but most importantly, the government, I hope Mr. Haguma and other people in the government can listen to this. I think we need to keep it on. We urge the government to do away with shutdowns, internet shutdowns, because at this point, internet is not only a human right, but an enabler of human rights, okay? And there's so much that can be done, but also there's so many effects that an internet shutdown can even span off online, because now the people are leaving the online space and just playing in the offline space. There's no communication, there's no what is going on. But even in a time when internet is the biggest key and the biggest player when it comes to fighting COVID, I think it's important that we all stay online. Well, for our listeners, thank you so much. That is all from us today. Thank you for joining us, and stay tuned. And look out for our next episodes as we present to you voices and perspectives of human rights defenders in Uganda.
Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. And if you have any feedback or you need to learn more about the Digital Human Rights Lab, visit www.digitalhumanrightslab.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at DHR Lab, on Instagram at DIGHUMRIGHTS Lab, on Facebook, Digital Human Rights Lab. Until next time, from all of us to you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.